Blog Talk Radio.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم. بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. السلام عليكم ورمضان مبارك. Welcome, welcome, welcome. We are so happy that you have decided to join us again for another opportunity to talk about marriage and relationships with Mariam Blog Talk. That is Muslim American Research Institute Advocating Marriage. I am your facilitator, Camila Shuaid, and we will definitely be joined by my co-host and our esteemed scholar on the subject of relationships, Imam Fahim Shuaib. So I'm really looking forward to that. I pray that everyone's Ramadan is going well. It seems like this week went by so fast. You know, we're almost at the end of our first week of Ramadan. We're really starting to get in the hang of things. You know, the first 3 days, adjusting is always different, but it's a blessing in that adjustment because we know that through this time, this is the only time we'll get. You know, we're not promised another year of getting a chance to see Ramadan or experience Ramadan. So it's a blessing every single time we get an opportunity to have Ramadan be a part of our lives once again. So today we're going to have a very good discussion. First, let me note, because next week, because we are in the season of Ramadan and we have people who are listening from all coasts, we will start next week at 3 o'clock. I'll definitely indicate that online. But we'll begin our radio program at 3 o'clock and go from 3 in the specific time, 3 to, what is that, 3 to 4, 5, 3 to 5, and so that we can respect the time change for those that are on the other coast where it's near breakfast time, because we don't want people to miss out on the information, and we don't want to lead into their time when it's time to break fast and they're planning to be at the masjid for a community iftar or tarawih. We don't want to interfere with that. So we're going to move our time down 1 hour during this blessed month of Ramadan. And so just make note, and we will indicate it online, that we will begin at 3 o'clock starting next Wednesday. And today, because of the time change, we're only going to be online. Our program's going to be 1 hour long, so we're going to get right to it. But I just wanted to indicate those things, and I'll remind everyone as well as people are starting to log on to our wonderful program now. So today we're going to talk about one of my favorite, well, they're all my favorite subjects. I always say one of my favorite subjects, but they're all my favorite subjects. And today we are going to talk about the Pygmalion Project, and we'll get some more details. But before we go into that, I want to share with you this article that I got off of a website called blackandmarriedwithkids.com. And this is a husband and wife team who provides articles to Essence magazines, and they have some films and documentaries that we have used on our Mariam conference, and we have discussions around it because they bring up some really good topics, and they advocate the ideal of marriage and how important that is. So I'm going to share with this little tidbit, and it'll help us to kind of feed into the subject we're going to talk about. And it's called The List. Should you have a list of requirements for a potential mate? Now, I've heard many people bring this subject up. You know, are your expectations realistic? Is this a real expectation of, does this human being even exist that you have in your mind? And how do we, you know, manifest that? Or are we trying to manifest something that's a figment of our imagination? So here's a little tidbit from this article. Since the debut of TLC's member Chili's dating reality show called What Chili Wants, there have been a lot of conversations over her list for dating requirements. While it's not my place to tell another person what should or should not be important to them, in my opinion, Chili should change the name of her perfect man list to the reason why Chili will be 50 years old on a reality show looking for a man list. This list has at least 15 necessities that range from can't smoke to the seemingly meaningless he can't eat pork or he has to have a six-pack. Chili says that she will not compromise on this list of items and encourages every woman to have a list of her own. I never had a list I actually wrote down or even thought of as a list, but if I am to be honest with myself, there are certain requirements that I had in mind, even if I hadn't given them much thought. So we hear a lot, that's the end of the article, and the writer of the article, her name is Aja Dorsey Jackson. So we hear a lot of times women talk about, you know, he has to be 6'2", brown eyes. You know, they go through physical aspects of what this makes you look like. Men and women, let me be very clear. Men and women have certain expectations of what their expectations are. And then there, very rarely have I heard many characteristics. Usually I'll hear character traits from individuals who had been married before. And then they're clear about, okay, I need someone who is charitable, sense of humor, those different type of things, you know. So I mainly hear that more characteristic expectations from individuals who have been married before as opposed to individuals who have not been married before. That's what my experience is. I'm not making a generalization, but that's my experience. That's what I've heard many times. So sometimes our expectations are these ideas. We see certain movies. We see certain characters. You know, we watch The Notebook or we watch Twilight or we watch, you know, different shows on TV or Lifetime romance stories, and we're like, ah, that is the guy, or oh, that is the woman that we're looking for, not taking into consideration the realities of just living in this world. You know, dating or courting is always more exciting because at that time they're making time around their work schedule, they're making time around the children, or so then the reality of it is once you get married, some people say they lose the romance. No, it's not that they lost the romance. Now you're in business. You know, this it's the ideal, and then you're beginning to build the business. And you have to decide, hey, is this someone I want to build this business with? And this business that I'm talking about is marriage. So when we start to talk about those characteristics, we're going to look at our thinking about mate selection or our thinking about the reality of this quote-unquote list. I think there's good to have expectations, but it's also good to have healthy, realistic expectations. So that's what brings us to the Pygmalion Project. And it could be a source of great, you know, great source of conflicts within marriage and outside of marriage. You know, it could hinder a single person from finding a mate, and it can be a challenge for married couples because they're busy trying to tailor this person to this figment in their this ideal in their head about relationships. So at this time, I'm going to go ahead and ask Imam Shuaib to come on and introduce to us what is the Pygmalion Project and how does that affect mate selection and or marriages.
Well, alhamdulillah, bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Let me begin with this, just in case people haven't heard this bit of humor. Can you hear me okay?
Yeah, you have a little bit of echo, but I can hear you.
Okay. All right. So I think you may be hearing me through because, you know, we're in some proximity, so some of it may be coming through yours. You can, in the meantime, maybe if you just mute yours while you're not speaking, and then
okay.
Then that'll probably be better.
We're all good. Right.
All right. So this little story. So one day a woman goes into a store rather nervously and she starts climbing the stairs. This is the husband's store, right? And when she gets to the first floor, there's a sign on the door that says, "These men have jobs." So you can get off on any floor in order to get the husband that you want. So she's husband shopping, right? And so women go there to choose husbands, but they have to follow very specific instructions. You can visit the store only once, and then there are six floors. And the value of the product increases as you go up. That is, the qualities and characteristics of the men improve as you go up. They said, now you can choose any item from a particular floor, or you can choose to go on to the next floor, but you can't go back down except to exit the building. So once you pass one floor, you can't You can't say, well, let me go back to the previous world. No, the only way to go is out. After you decide that you want or don't want what you have, then you got to go down. So one woman goes into the store rather nervously, and she starts climbing the stairs. And when she gets to the first floor, the sign reads, "These men have jobs, floor one. These men have jobs." She thinks, oh, I can do better than that, and she keeps going to the second floor. On the second floor, the sign reads, "These men have jobs and love kids." Nice, but she goes on up another floor. The third floor sign reads, "These men have jobs, love kids, and are extremely good looking." She says, wow, I feel compelled to keep on going. And she does. She goes to the fourth floor, and the sign reads, "These men have jobs, love kids, are extremely good-looking, and they help with the housework." And so she says, "Whoa, mercy me," she exclaims. And then she said, "But I can hardly stand it." But still she goes on to the fifth floor, right? She says, "Now, these men have jobs, love kids, they're extremely good-looking, they help with the housework, and they have a very strong romantic streak." So she's tempted to stay there with all of these good qualities, but she goes to the sixth floor, and the sign reads, "You are the 31,456,012th woman to this floor. There are no men on this floor. This floor exists solely as proof that women are impossible to please. Thank you for shopping at the woman's store." Now, there's a counterpart to the men, counterpart to the men's side, but we'll hold that. So the idea, of course, the message is that you want this and you want that and you want this and you want that, and you keep piling on the attributes, piling on the requirements, piling on the qualities, and they actually price you out of the market for those for whom that is an issue. Now, the Pygmalion Project is particularly it's based on a myth. Well, actually, Pygmalion Project comes from what's the author's name? I believe the author's name is Stephen Humphreys. Montgomery, I think his name. But in any case, it's a publication that actually deals with temperament sorter types, and he explains a myth, but the myth is designed to clarify a particular mindset in a person. So it's a Greek myth, and it speaks to one of the greatest sources of conflict in marriage. This sculptor, his name was Pygmalion, and what he decides is to carve a sculpture of his ideal woman. That is, she would embody every ideal attribute and virtue. The figure was so perfect that he fell in love with his own creation. Soon, however, he became unhappy because the lifeless marble statue couldn't return his warmth and his love. So the Pygmalion Project is actually speaking to a project that a person may be committing themselves to when they already in a marriage, being in a marriage, they continue to try to reshape or reform the other person into who they think they should be. And so they're trying to shape them according to an ideal image that they have in their mind. But that ideal image that they have in their mind, as when the condition is, of course, born out of this unrealistic set of expectations and these unrealistic goals and aims for a living flesh and blood person, that means that those ideals don't actually exist in a person living in flesh and blood anywhere. So it's an imagination. But then they work to try to, in the case of someone who's already married, they work to try to fashion and shape their mate into that ideal image, which itself is unreal. Or if they are unmarried and seeking a mate, they go out with that shopping list, as you were pointing out. They go out with that shopping list trying to find someone who fits the bill of their profile, of that person. So the Pygmalion Project, it basically represents a negative project that you could be on if you don't have the right perspective on the mate, either potential mate or the one with whom you are currently mated. So that's basically what it is.
All right, I thought you were still going. I wanted to make sure that I had my sound back on. Okay, so here's one thing that I wanted to ask you about. How does, you know, you mentioned about being temperament, that it has to do with temperament. So I'm going to use myself as an example. When I think about, you know, what my temperament is, and in that is me being an extrovert, you know, or in the place of an artisan, you know, those different characteristics are identified. So how do we as Muslims apply those things? How is it affirmed about our temperaments in al-Islam?
Okay, one of the things, because we always want people to understand that Maryam is an institution, it is an institute, it is on a mission, and that mission is to enhance, improve the married life and the approaches to marriage that are undertaken by Muslim Americans. So as a research institute, a part of the research methodology is driven by a certain principle, and one of the principles that is driven by is the fact that much of the problem, source of the problem in the Muslim world today, just in general, not just that, particularly Islamic social sciences are a shortcoming in the Islamic world. It's something that never really was formally developed in a very real sense, but very, very necessary. And so I subscribe to what Dr. Abdul Hamid Abu Suleiman says in his Islamic Theory of International Relations. He says this in part, talking about the shortcomings of leadership in the Islamic world in the years before the Muslim decline. And he says this. He said they were unaware of the repercussions of the new knowledge and methods on the composition, interaction, and organization of society, nor were they able to envision the potential of this new knowledge harnessed to the values, goals, and overall paradigm of al-Islam. What he's saying is that new knowledge came online. We're talking about right in around the 5th century Hijra, which for us is around 12th, 13th century, and across the board in so many spheres, for as far as material science, production, innovations in industry, and the like, those kinds of things. New sciences were coming online. Many of them, of course, in Europe, had actually been fostered by the thrust of Islamic scholarship into that world, either by way of the Crusades or by way of the presence of Muslims in Europe. But in any case, the new knowledge that was evolving upon it, there were those Muslims who were the leadership. Not only was there what you call internecine strife between the political and the theological leadership among the Muslims, while they were having this internal strife between the political and the religious side or theological side of it, they were also neglecting the real developments that were taking place on the ground among the people and with the developments that were happening in Europe, again, with this new knowledge. And so they, as the professor is pointing out, they became unaware of the impact of this new knowledge on the composition. Now put these attributes together, or put these qualities together with what he's talking about. They didn't understand how this knowledge and how these new methods, how they're going to impact the composition of society, the interaction in society, the organization of society. Not only were they unaware of these impacts on these aspects of society, they also could not see how to use that new knowledge harnessed to the values, goals, and overall paradigm of Islam. And this is what led to something of a dark age among the Muslims. The fall and decline of the Muslims had everything to do with their failure to make the connection with new knowledge. And so we, of course, don't want to make that mistake, and we know that not making that mistake is what holds out our success. Okay, so what do? We look at the new knowledge Yes, in fields of social science and field of psychology and field of human sciences that have been developed and established. You know, we're not talking astrology, we're not talking numerology, we're not talking whatever, any other kind of stuff, you know, tea leaf reading, palm reading, anything like that. We're talking about established scientific perspective, scientific research and knowledge that can be verified and has a foundation of support in al-Islam, okay? So what we're talking about right here, right now, at this point, is the issue of temperament, that people have different temperaments. Is a critical piece that Muslims need to understand, going back to Dr. Abdul Hamid Suleiman's statement, that Muslims need to understand how temperaments affect the composition, how temperaments affect interaction, how temperaments affect the organization of society. It is the temperaments of people that have everything to do with the way and the nature of society and the way people interact with each other. Also, it's important to see how we can use and understand this idea and this science related to temperaments, and how can we connect them with our values, our goals, and our overall paradigm of al-Islam. And in this particular quarter, we're talking about how can we relate the science of temperaments to al-Islam and to mate selection. That's what we're saying here. So, of course, we always have to go and begin first with the Quran. You have to start with the Quran. In order to provide, you know, justification for entrance, you know, this bringing these ideas in. Okay, well, they gotta pass the gate, the threshold of al-Islam, and say, okay, does al-Islam say anything about temperaments? Does al-Islam say anything about these differentials in the qualities and the character traits of individuals? And it most certainly does. You start with the Quran itself, the 17th chapter, the 84th verse of the Quran. It says, say everyone acts according to their own disposition. That's what the Yusuf Ali translation said. Well, that same word, shakila, can be translated as temperaments now in the context of this knowledge. So everyone acts according to his own temperament. That's a simple fact that's verified by experience. So experience makes it a fact. Yeah, that is, for as far as our human interaction is concerned, everybody has different temperaments. And that's a fact that has to be established. That's a fact that has to be understood. That's a fact that has to be embraced. That's a fact that has to be incorporated in how we interact with others. And that verse goes on. It says, but your Lord knows best who it is that is best guided on the way. Further, Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alaihi wasallam, he also points out to us explicitly that everyone has different temperaments. And the Prophet said this. He said, the descendants of Adam have been created in various categories. That's the translation. The words can be changed to say Adam has been created according to different temperaments, right? Some are born believers and they live and die as believers. Some are born infidels, unbelievers, and they live and die as unbelievers. Some are born as believers and they live as believers but die as unbelievers. And then some are born as unbelievers and they live as unbelievers but they die as believers. So that's the category of class of people. Another report of the Prophet specifically speaks to the temperaments and more explicitly. Even you can hear in the word temperament, you can hear temper in it, temper, right? He said you got a quick temper, you got a short temper, right? So temperament is the emotional mentality. That's really what it's saying, the emotional mentality. Because the temper is having to do with the level of heat, passion, emotion, et cetera, and mint is talking about the mind. So it's the temperature of your mind, the temperature of your mind. The Prophet, sallallahu alaihi wasallam, goes to that explicitly here. He says some, speaking of these four categories of people, he said some are swift to anger and swift to cool down. That's one type of temperament. And the hadith goes on, the one characteristic making up for the other. Some are slow to anger and slow to cool down, the one characteristic making up for the other. But the best of you are those who are slow to anger and swift to cool down, and the worst of you are those who are swift to anger and slow to cool down. So here, the hadith of Muhammad sallallahu alaihi wasallam in the Quran is telling us everybody has different dispositions. Everybody has different temperaments. And so when Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala talks about he created for you mates of like nature, we're not talking about human beings versus animals, okay, in that like nature. We're talking about people who have similar dispositions, similar orientations to life and the like. That really is what temperament is all about. And you say?
Yes, I'm still here. So then let me ask you in regards to temperament, how do we gauge a realistic expectation of our mate selection? Because we talked about the list, right? How people create this list. And I know that you have done talked about, you know, the real Muslim man, the real Muslim woman, and what that looks like. Because some of the questions that have come up last week were about, you know, maintaining your individuality and being able to be with someone and maintain being an individual, that expectations are not placed upon your mate because they don't do it the way you do. Okay, you cut your pancakes in triangles, they cut theirs in squares, and it just bugs you, right? So how do you gauge the realistic expectations in the mate selection, and how do we identify, you know, if someone is trying to reshape or mold a current mate? They're already married, and they're trying to mold this individual into what it is that they want them to be. And when do you decide that it's a good fit or not a good fit?
Well, firstly, the critical thing is to just simply affirm that people have different temperament. I mean, that's going to shape your temperament. That's going to shape your whoever, that individual's particular temperament is going to be shaped by their acknowledgement of that fact, their acknowledgement of the fact that people have different temperaments. And so you go in with that, right? Now, the background to all this, and it's very important, we said Muslim American Research Institute advocating marriage. The backdrop of all of this is that what is quote unquote assumed in our conversation, and what people have to have incorporated in their lens or their filter as they consider what we're saying, and as we say what we're saying, is it's upon the foundation of saying that these are Muslims who believe in Allah and who themselves want to obey Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, and who have some idea of what Allah's design is of. We can start at the very basic. Designed for the human being, that is designed for the human being in terms of their nature, and designed for the human being, both male and female, the design for the human being, male and female, in relationship to him, the design for that male and female in relationship to each other. And so it's against that particular blueprint that everything that we say is to be considered. So some of the primary steps are you personally, individual, have to understand and accept that people are of different temperaments. And so therefore, you're always going to be interacting with people whose temperament is not necessarily like yours. But that there are people who do have temperaments like a temperament like yours, because Allah said he created for you mates of like nature. So yes, that is. And really, one of the simple ways. Yeah, there's a little evaluation that has to be done after the fact. But the starting point is your initial response to the person. Your response to the person. It's like if you have this response to the person, like I like that person, right? And you have this sense of where that like is being registered at. You know, if you just start at the top of your body. And then just move the Geiger counter down, and wherever it click 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 clicks the most as you move down, you're scanning your own body. Then you have some idea of where the appetite or where the liking is generating from. Is it generating from your head? Is it generating from your heart? Is it generating from your stomach? Is it generating from your reproductive area? Is it generating from your legs, whatever. The point is, I'm trying to say that you have to have some idea as to what is really driving you to quote unquote like the person. I'm talking about unmarried people at this moment. So, but if there's a registry there, and then you have some idea of what that registry is, okay, well then you have a good starting point. But that is all it is, a starting point. But now you have to get in situations where you can get some sense of the temperament of the person, right? In terms of, you know, how are they? Are they emotionally stable? Are they emotionally unstable? Are they quick tempered? Are they, you know, there's so many other things. We have another list, and I don't know if we want to go through that list because there's a list on the issue of compatibility of things that have to be considered. Or that should be considered. And these are actually also sources of conversation because one of the things that a person has to learn how to do, it is necessary for you to talk to that person that you are also you're considering seriously in that regard. And one of them is to find out if they're on first base. And the first base is, okay, are they believing in God? Or are they wanting to marry with the intention to serve the plan of God? Or, you know, what are we thinking the same way in this particular aspect? That's one. But then there is another list of things that we make useful or that we make available to people vis-a-vis the Merriam conferences so that they can know what kind of conversation they need to have in order to get a better determination as to whether that person has even a general compatibility beyond your liking them, but there are other aspects that need to be looked into to find out if, in fact, they are actually, quote-unquote, compatible with you. Do you want to go through that list, or is that too much?
No, I think that it is a good idea to give us an idea of what that is. For those that are, let me just give this little side note. For those that are joining us now, welcome. I wanted to let you know that today's program will only be an hour long in respect of those who will be breaking fast on the other coast. And starting next week, we will begin, during the month of Ramadan, we will begin at 3 o'clock Pacific Standard Time so that we can respect the time of those who will be breaking fast on the other coast and not to interfere with their Ramadan festivities, whether it's just for their own time or community joining. So we are going to move our program up just during the month of Ramadan to 3 o'clock Pacific Standard Time. Keep an eye online, and we'll definitely send those reminders out. But, yes, I think that is a very important component to know what that list is, because sometimes we get emotionally tied in and then we don't know how to let go. That's when the tailoring begins, you know,
right?
Because you've opened yourself to this individual. You enjoy talking to them because they're a nice person, but they may not be the individual that is ideal for creating a lifelong partnership with in marriage. So it's always good to be prepared to have the, you know, at the gate, like, okay, well, they may not be that good fit for me, but I know someone who may be a good fit for them, you know,
exactly.
To cut that off. So, yes, I think that would be really good to know. What is that list?
Yeah, that's very important. I'm going to go to the list right there, but I want to latch on to that, the last point that you make. So, if the person is not necessarily fit for me, what you get to know about them will enable you to say about people closer to you that you're familiar with that they might be a fit for somebody else. And our national survey that we did on marriage actually pointed out that one of the greatest sources of the forming of marriages was from friends and family, you know, as opposed to whatever, online or college or what have you, friends and family. That's very important. Also, as we spoke last week, we talked about the Moses method for getting God's assistance. And a part of that is you can actually, while you're looking out for somebody else, that's also one of the ways of getting the assistance and the help that you need. So that is something to always have it in mind, you know, that as you speak to someone, then maybe they might be a good fit for somebody else if they're not for you. And by being willing and interested in finding a good fit for the other person, that opens you up for that to begin to work on your behalf because, you know, God helps those who help each other. So,
right.
Okay, so let's look at this list. It's a decent little list, but there are very particular areas that need to be considered, right? And each area is an opportunity for a discussion. So anything you want to stop and land on, spend a little more time on, you know, we can if you like. But right now, we'll just go through the list. You know, that is, one is you want to find out and consider if the person has similar ethnic and cultural background. That's important. That it's important in terms of a factor to understand, right? Don't get all into, just in case for those who do, don't get all into, well, you know, Islam, we all just human beings, and, you know, it shouldn't be about this and that. There are some material facts related to the distinctions in ethnic background, cultural background, that make a difference when you get up close and personal in a marriage. They might not be factors out front when you're passionately on the search or what have you, but they are going to come full force into your life when you wind up in the marriage together, right? It brings to mind, mashallah, you know, I wind up watching those little single ladies. I think it is the single ladies that one. Where the dude was, he was a personal trainer, and then he's African American, and she's a Caucasian, and he was just a personal trainer, and so they weren't looking at each other as you know, an item for attack. They were just friends, right? Well, then it flipped, and they became an item, right? So she was saying that's how she liked him, and she liked him more than just as a friend. It's okay, so it was on, right? And so then once they got into a new relationship, see, it was a different relationship before, but when they come into that new, more personal relationship, then it starts coming out that he has all his demanding, controlling kind of things that, you know, certain things aren't acceptable now that we're married that were acceptable before. Well, that's all of that same kind of thing, the kind of thing that happens with the ethnic and the cultural background. You know, that a person brings with them a particular set of quote-unquote issues, traits, characteristics that come from their ethnic and cultural background. And you need to know what they are, even if you find, oh, I like this person. I'm African-American, he's Arab. I'm Caucasian, he's African-American. What have you? You need to get those issues worked out. So another personal histories, the personal history of the individual. I mean, you need to know what this person's personal history is. That all goes back to the issue of syzygy. I mean, why is it important? And, you know, maybe we should ask that about each one of these circumstances. Why is that important? And one of it is important because the person's personal history is what has actually made the person who they are. As the Quran says, "Kullu ya'malu ala shakila." Everyone acts according to their shakila. That could also be translated as everyone acts according to their personal history. And so, if you don't know that person's personal history, then you may come into some, you know, ghosts and goblins, you know, what have you, after you get into the relationship with the person. But if you have that conversation beforehand, then you get a heads up, if you will, so you know whether you want to go any further. Also, the person's socioeconomic status. Are you similar? Are you different? Socioeconomically speaking, right? I mean, did you come from across the tracks and they come from on the hill? You know, where is that? How does that play out? How significant? Socioeconomic issues. There's a certain standard of living that one is used to or one is expecting, right? And that represents the value that they want to have. But when you first meet the person, you don't necessarily know that about their socioeconomic status. You know, you might meet them in the wherever or wherever, okay, but then that doesn't tell you everything about them. You haven't been to their house, you haven't been to their apartment, you haven't been to their neighborhood, you haven't met the relatives, et cetera. You know, you don't know what the but you need to know what the socioeconomic status is, so you know whether it's a move up or a move down or what is required in order to be able to live in the way that particular mate may have lived or have in mind. Economic attitudes, you know, what are your attitudes about finance? What are your attitudes about money? I mean, you know, maybe some are just really, you know, they really want to hold tight to that dollar and let it go at the last possible moment. others. You're very free and open-handed with it. I mean, you're to a fault in the sense of, you know, less conservative or less frugal than you or what have you. You need to have that idea, how they deal with money, right? How they deal with the idea of, okay, we need to do this. I know it wasn't in the plan, but now we got to take care of this. What are their attitudes? What are their attitudes around that? Let me do this. I closed your mic. I was getting a little feedback, but you see, I'm going down the list about four, and there are about seven or eight more. How you want to continue?
Well, at this time, because we're coming close to then, I want to provide an opportunity for our listeners, if you have any particular questions before we go any further down the list, what you would do is you would press 1 on your keypad, and we can acknowledge you, and you can ask your question. And keep it as brief as possible, because we are going to stay within our time constraint. If you have any particular questions, just press 1 on your keypad. Okay, so I want to bring up something along the lines of what you were saying, because when we start to think about Islamically, you know, knowing how to approach these questions, I know that for me, I can get pretty shy about certain questions to ask, like what's okay to ask and what's not okay to ask, and at what point, you know, timing. What is the timing of asking these particular questions? So is there any advice as to how to approach that in asking those questions?
Sure, absolutely. And the Muslim American Research Institute advocating marriage, one of the things that we're striving for is the establishment of a national Wali association, because one of the things that has found to be agreed to by 98% of the respondents is that Walis play a very important role in the marriage process. Now, some of these questions can be fun and entertaining and the like as a source of conversation over dinner, if you will. You know, ethnic background, cultural background, personal histories, you know, those kind of things. You know, what kind of neighborhood did they live in and grow up in? Those socioeconomic status questions, right? You know, but with other issues, you know, mashallah, it is, as we say, it is what it is for as far as economic questions and the like. Those questions can become sensitive, especially when you're not married. And yeah, they can be sensitive when you are married, but they can be particularly sensitive when you are. So as far as that is concerned, those kinds of questions, those kind of sensitive questions, are questions that one's wali should actually, for those who are not married, for those obviously who are not married, but considering a person seriously, then they should have their representative to ask those sensitive questions to the other party. So then you don't have to deal with the uneasiness related to that question, but that the questions have to be asked because of the level of commitment you make when you marry. When you marry, you blend two lives. So it's like you're literally putting your life into a situation. And so you need to have the answers to those questions before, making the match. So the wali, that's my answer. The answer is, you know, you need to have a representative to ask the person who is at that level of seriousness. You have them to ask those questions. You don't even have to ask those questions.
Okay, great. I don't see anyone popping up with any questions. If you do have any questions, you could type them in on our chat line. Or you could press 1 on your keypad. I'm going to give you just about 2 seconds, and then we're going to continue down the list. Okay. All right, great. So you can go ahead, carry on to the next couple of list items.
Okay. The another aspect, things to be known. All these things you're talking about, trying to decide, are you mates of like nature? Do you have this compatibility? Yeah, and it's also to let us know that, and we, I believe we all see and know that, and that's broad to say we all see and know. I think a great many of us see and know that it's not enough for somebody to say, he's a Muslim, she's a Muslim, he's got a Muslim name, she got a Muslim name, he wears kufi, she wears scarves, whatever you want to say. He goes to Juma, she goes to Juma, what have you, and then they get married, and so that ought to be it. It ought to be cool. It ought to work because you got all those main pieces in place. You know, he follows W. E. Mama, she follows W. E. Mama. Just get, make it as particular as you want, all those broad strokes. But how many marriages have collapsed, you know, in the presence of all of those things, right? And it's because of these types of things that are not understood well enough in advance of the marriage, which in some instances would have actually precluded the marriage from ever taking place, which sometimes people fear. You know, sometimes people fear, male and female. But I would say, unfortunately, there's a greater proclivity of the female to make a decision that is not, you know, a decision not to know or to not to ask. It's like you were just mentioning about the sensitivity in the questions, sometimes not asking, not recognizing, or turning a blind eye to some signals, which actually her woman's intuition actually does tell you, but you kind of, you there are those who make the decision to be blind to that, and as a result, mashallah, there turns out to be a horrible price to be paid for it. And no doubt men absolutely do the same thing as well. But because of the nature of the relationship, because of the nature of the, how women relate to relationships and marriage, which is much more, there's much more energy for it and motivation towards it in the women in general than men, then she becomes more vulnerable to, again, being decidedly blind to certain things or being excessively dependent on the man being okay, and she's less willing to make those decisions to turn this thing off or to let it go because of that very gravity towards relationships that are there. But the point is that these matters, when you look into these matters and when you get an idea of what scale of acceptability this person has for you in a relationship, then if they don't match up well, if they don't, you know, come up to standards that your heart and mind, you know, can be comfortable with, then you do have to say, well, okay, well, this is not going to work. But as was said, you know, well, maybe it won't work for you. Maybe it might work for somebody else. So all these things we're talking about are things that are, they have to be looked into before you actually say, I do. Okay? The other thing, the similar religious backgrounds and thinking and sensitivity. See, that's important. So it's just like, you know, you have those who marry across madhhab lines. Let's just put it like that. You know, the quote-unquote sectarian lines, we'll call it, the W.D. Muhammad community, marrying someone that is Maliki or marrying someone that is Afrocentric or marrying someone that is inclined to the Wahhabi way or what have you, or whatever the other, Salaf, whatever. So the point is you marry across there. Well, you have actually different religious backgrounds, different religious thinking, different religious sensitivities. You need to know what those religious background sensitivities and thinking are. And again, it doesn't mean that just because they go to the same masjid that you go and sit on the floor with you for Jumu'ah or what have you, it doesn't mean that they actually see the religion the same way that you see it or see it the same way that the imam presents it, given that the imam is presenting it correctly, let's say. Knowing that is very important. Knowing the religious sensitivity, the religious background, religious thinking of the one you consider is critical. Also, traditions, celebrations with family and friends, for example. You know, so you got, are you marrying someone whose family never had birthday parties? You know, never went on family vacation or never had celebrations, never did the Halloween thing, what have you? You know, that has to do with a big part of it, because when children and family formally comes into play, that's going to be critical as to the sensibilities, sensitivities, what feels good and what feels bad at what time of the year in your family life. So you need to understand how they relate to traditions, celebrations, and family and friends. What kind do they have? What kind did you have? Are the ones that you have incompatible with the ones that they had, and vice versa? Those are things that you need to know. And also the way that you are parented. You know, how were they parented? Were they born to a single mother that never married, or was were they born to parents that were married but they divorced early, or married to parents but then that is married to a pair of parents, that is, they were born to a pair of parents, but the relationship was dysfunctional or abusive or drug dependent or what have parenting that has a lot. Were the parents educated, or the parents minimally educated? Were their parents blue collar, white collar, what have you? All these things have to do with, you know, that person's parenting themselves, and also the way that they will parent, given that you have children. So I'm kind of chopping this up in like four or five each. You want to chime in on anything?
Yeah, I would say that along with that, that when we start to look at the family background and those things, what about the issues of, you know, someone who is Muslim or non-Muslim or a convert, you know, that those, I have seen relationships in those situations work, and I've seen them that where they don't work. So are those, and then there's always the conversation of, is that okay, you know, for a Muslim to marry someone who is a non-Muslim? So if you could speak on that.
Yeah, that question, I've asked that question recently, and on other occasions. I don't have the document in front of me, and I expect to give that person as well as this group a more formal response. But let me give you my thumbnail response right now. The forbidding to marry is not forbidding to marry non-Muslims. The forbidding is the marriage to mushriks. Mushriks. That's the key. It's not non-Muslim, because all non-Muslims are not non-believers. That's very important. And that's one of the primary mistakes that's made when people talk about marrying a non-Muslim. You can't marry a non-Muslim. Wait a minute. I can't marry a mushrik. I can't marry a mushrik. That's what the Quran has ordered. I can't marry a mushrik. What is a mushrik? Mushrik is someone that sees God as not soul, unique, ahad, oneness, and outside of creation, and who has partners, equals, sharers in his divinity. If they have any idea that God is sharing, or that God has a weakness, that he has to be supported by some aid or assistance, or that God is something or someone in the material creation, then that person is most likely a mushrik. If those are the views that they hold about God, that person there is a mushrik. And for a Muslim, then that is what Allah is forbidding for them. And that's both male and female. So if they're a Christian that believes that Jesus is the Son of God, or God in the flesh, or God in the person, or what have you, that's a mushrik. That's a mushrik. They can believe in Jesus like we believe in Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alaihi wasallam, but they cannot believe that Jesus is God. They cannot believe that Jesus is the Son of God, and we marry them. That's what's forbidden. That's what's forbidden. So it's about mushrik, and it can be a Hindu or anybody else. You know, it's a Buddhist. Or, you know there are Buddhists who don't believe that there is a God. There is no God. There is no God, right? So that takes the Buddhists out, because they do not believe in God. So they are, you know, unbelievers in the formal sense of not believing in God. It doesn't mean that Buddhists, and let me be real clear, doesn't mean that they're not Buddhists that don't have good character, good ethics, good morals, good behavior, won't lie, steal, lie, steal, cheat, or kill. That's tongue tied. No water. But you can't. But the point is, it's about how they relate to God. That's a critical thing, how they relate to God. If they have a relationship with God that does not admit or does not hold the uniqueness that we perceive about God, is unique. They don't have to believe in all the attributes per se or know them. But the one has to be is that he is the creator, and he is nothing in creation. He is all powerful and he needs no help and assistance from any. Okay, if they believe that and they accept that as a belief, well then even if they're not a Muslim, they're not a mushrik. Okay, so that's for as far as that goes. What was the other part of your question?
No, that was pretty much it. But I, because we're coming close to the end of this segment, those that are joining us, our program is going to be short out of respect for those that will be breaking fast on the other coast. And we will be starting our Maryam Blog Talk radio program at 3 o'clock during the month of Ramadan. But I did want to say, because this is going to be a very social month for us this month, and speaking as a single woman myself and any other listeners who are unmarried, that what are some suggestions that you would say that we should do? Because you said that the best way to do that is through friends and family, you know.
Yeah.
So is it good to vocalize that to individuals that you entrust to say, you know, hey, I'm looking to be married?
Oh,
what are some suggested ways we should move in that direction? Because this is probably the most social time that we'll be getting together as Muslims is this season.
Oh, yeah, most definitely. This is the perfect time to be on the lookout in the most righteous sense because there are so many social events that are going on. I mean, it's perfect. I mean, you know, you have an iftar with people that you don't normally see throughout the year, and in informal situations, you know, it's like, you know, it's perfect for that. And again, this is one of the recommendations that Maryam makes to people in terms of facilitating marriages, because I'm talking about, let's talk non-Ramadan period of time. Okay, then aunties, uncles, moms, dads, sisters, brothers, cousins, friends, whatever. Hey, why don't you have a social event, game night or whatever, at your house or at somebody else's house, blah, 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 and invite, you know, possibles, you know, over for that, right? And so that's an opportunity where you're in a situation where it's informal. You have a chance to get a feel for that person, how they feel around your friends and relatives, or how you feel around their friends and relatives. You know, who do they like? Who is like them? And you know what I'm saying? That gives you an idea. Oh, okay, it's like that. So you have an idea of if you want to be in that mix at all, right? So that's a perfect time in terms of that. I say also, and I think this is something, you know, the culture has given us to it, but I think many women particularly have thrown that out the door and they need to put it back. The quickest way to a man's heart is through his stomach is what the culture says, right? So if a woman can cook and she knows she can cook, hey, that's an important thing. I mean, so she needs to have the iftar at her place, right? And invite the friends around for the cushion, you know what I'm saying? And have the person that she's interested in, have them also to come over for iftar, right? Invited vis-a-vis a friend, blah, blah. So then they come, and she's the one that's provided the iftar food, right? So now when he starts tasting that chicken, he starts tasting that salad, when he starts sipping that soup and blue, 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 it's like, okay, some light's going to start coming on. So that's a very positive aspect to create this kind of the environment that kind of assists in the process of screening and attracting if need be. That's what I would say. That's one of the primary things that should be done. So during the iftar, during Ramadan, make sure that the people who know you and who care about you are looking out for you in that interest. And then also have situations where you can, even like, let's say if there were a number of unmarried women, for example, I'm going from this side of it, the unmarried women, so where they're going to have an iftar, you know, and there's going to be iftar at somebody's house, but then all of them are providing the meal. Okay, Shahida, she did the salad. You know, Rashida, she did the soup. And, give me another name. Aliyah, she did the lamb, what have you. Okay, so there, and the guys are over there, the guys that are over there, you know, they tasted all of it, you know. And that also becomes a way to give them some information and also perhaps provide an attraction at another level.
All right, great. Well, we are coming to an end. I wanted to remind our listeners we will begin our Radio Blog Talk program at 3 o'clock during the month of Ramadan. Also be looking online to be reminded of that. We thank you all so much for joining us for this talk, and it's obviously a more extensive conversation that we will definitely continue on, and we thank you once again for joining us for the Maryam Blog Talk radio program. I am Camila Mahasin Shuaib. Thank you so very much for joining us. Any closing remarks?
No, that's it. Now, anybody in the D.C. area, check in with Imam Talib over there, and they have a single to married Muslim group over there. I'm doing a webinar with them. It's not being broadcast, blog, you know, out. It's something that is going to be on location there. Just check, if you're in the D.C. area, check in, because it's actually going to be Skyped in. So, inshallah, check that out. And that's going to be on Saturday around Zuhr, East Coast time. So I think it's scheduled from like 2 to 4 East Coast time. But check in with the DC Masjid on that.
All right. Excellent. Well, thank you so very much for joining us and sharing that wonderful information. And we look forward to getting more information from you next week on Maryam Blog Talk Radio.
Alhamdulillah. Assalamu alaikum. Ramadan Mubarak.